Hello, everyone, and welcome to Genocide News Now from the Lemkin Institute. I'm your host, Molly Reagan. The Lemkin Institute for Genocide Prevention is an all-volunteer organization that relies on donations from individuals like you to cover operating costs. If you appreciate the clear-eyed, even-handed, and frank assessments of situations you care about, please consider making a one-time contribution or monthly gift on our website, or subscribe to this podcast on Patreon. Now, let's dive into the news. Old law professors always tease that international law is nice, but unenforceable. This is because international law, in most countries, is not an actual authoritative source of law, but instead is consulted on an ad hoc basis for advisory purposes. But developments in business law and human rights have brought a domestic element to international law. Currently, Dutch prosecutors, worried by the international pressure placed on the International Criminal Court, have forced the Open Bar Ministry, or Public Ministry, to evaluate 10 separate complaints lodged with them for further investigation. This would be the first time that a domestic court could be involved in an international criminal court process. If successful, it will force the Netherlands to take an official position on Gaza, as state agents would be arguing this position before a court. The possible charges, as it stands, is interference with the ICC. Put simply, in the Netherlands, it is unlawful for any actor to impede the work of the ICC or purposely prevent the ICC, including its staff, from performing their functions. It is alleged that Israeli intelligence over a 9-year period attempted to undermine and influence the ICC, as well as intimidate the office of the prosecutor. According to the joint investigation, Israeli intelligence intercepted numerous communications from the ICC, including Prosecutor Khan and former Prosecutor Bensouda. This included listening to phone calls, reading emails, and reviewing classified documents, all without any consent. This aided the Israeli executive in knowing what the ICC was planning, as well as access to work product from the prosecutor's office. While some may argue that Israel's actions were simply routine international spying, under the headquarter agreement between the Netherlands and the ICC, entered into force on the 1st of March 2008, the Netherlands is obliged to prevent any interference with the ICC. This dovetails with Article 70 of the Rome Statute, the founding treaty of the ICC, which makes it unlawful to interfere with the administration of criminal justice. This situation of an international agreement overlapping with the domestic law was also a catalyst for human rights lawyers to bring environmental suits against Royal Dutch Shell. Based on the operator's agreement, which creates substantial legal obligation, the Netherlands has the necessary jurisdiction to prosecute this matter. The consequence could be that the state is forced to withdraw support for Israel as a terrorist state or condemn Israel based on existing Dutch human rights laws. As the Lemkin Institute has said before, genocides, and especially genocide denial, thrive in uncertainty. Using vague language gives the much-needed room to downplay mass atrocities. The silence of the majority of EU member states has provided de facto consent to Israel's acts against the Palestinians. If Dutch judicial authorities were to take a position on Gaza, it would force the EU narrative to change. It is very possible that any court decision in the Netherlands would cascade through courts across Europe. Our next story takes us to Myanmar's western state of Rakhine. The military junta, known as the Tat Mada, is again clashing with Rakhine ethno-nationalist militias, leaving the Rohingya both in Rakhine and across the border in Bangladesh caught in the crossfire. Meanwhile, political upheaval and extreme flooding in Bangladesh further threaten the livelihoods of Rohingya refugees. We previously reported on the rise in forced conscription of the Rohingya by the pro-Tat Mada militias, and the worrying trend is only increasing. Nearly 1 million Rohingyas live in Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh, where they struggle to obtain basic services such as education and healthcare. Now, boys as young as 14 are being coerced, kidnapped, and forced back to Myanmar to fight for the military, which has committed genocide against them. Individuals living in Cox's Bazar report that it's practically run by gangs, and Rohingya militias supporting the Tat Mada are running aggressive recruitment campaigns. Others report that Bangladeshi authorities responsible for keeping order in the camp are complicit in the militias' activities. In myriad crises within Bangladesh threatened to undercut what few resources are available to the refugees. In Myanmar, most Rohingya live in the western Rakhine state. There, fighting has been intensifying between the military and ethnic militias after a rupture of a fragile ceasefire earlier this year. The military has engaged in repeated campaigns of forced displacement and torture against the Rohingya and have repressed ethnic minorities across the country for generations. With no democratic recourse, ethno-nationalist militias are often seen as the only route to freedom. One such group is the Arakan Army, which was formed in 2009 and represents the Rakhine minority, who dominate Rakhine State. The AA has both clashed with the Tatmadaw and attacked Rohingya civilians for years. In November 2023, the AA launched a new offensive against the military with the goal of establishing an independent Rakhine state. Civilian casualties and war crimes spread on all sides. As the AA has captured more and more territory, the military junta has begun working with the Rohingya militias and targeting Cox's Bazar for forced conscription. Amidst the conflict, anti-Rohingya violence in Rakhine is at its highest level since the 2017 genocide. Now Rohingya refugees in the Cox's Bazar are stuck between two genocidal groups with no clear path forward and a reduction in what little support they had. Men report fearing leaving their homes due to the risk of being forcibly conscripted. Some choose to fight for the military on the promise of receiving citizenship, but it has yet to materialize. Meanwhile, the AA refuses to acknowledge their existence, referring to the Rohingya as Bengali and denying their native status in Rakhine. The AA have also repeatedly massacred Rohingya civilians during their military operations. In retaliation for some Rohingya joining the military, the AA is also reportedly raising Rohingya villages. The dire political and environmental situations in Bangladesh are pushing the Rohingya even further to the brink. August saw violent protests in which Bangladeshi university students and other residents clashed with police, resulting in hundreds of deaths. The movement led to the ousting of Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, but political chaos is still ongoing under the interim government of Mohamed Yunus. Later, there was extreme flooding across the country, destroying critical infrastructure and forcing international aid organizations to pause their work. As a result, food aid received by the Rohingya is dwindling, leading to a 60% uptick in hunger. While Yunus has pledged support to the Rohingya, he stresses that international support will be a necessity. The Lemkin Institute finds it extremely concerning that refugees are fleeing the conflict only to be brought back into it. With the Tatmadaw targeting Cox's Bazar for forced conscription and floods further undermining support structures, there is nowhere left for one of the world's most vulnerable populations to turn. The Lemkin Institute calls on the international community to strengthen the rule of law within Cox's Bazar and redouble its support for the Bangladeshi government in its efforts to assist the Rohingya. On October 9, 2024, the citizens of Mozambique proceeded to the polls with the incumbent Frontline of Liberation of Mozambique, or Frelimo Party, seeking to continue its 49 years in power. This election is fresh off the Tuna Bond scandal, a series of illegal loans that triggered a persistent economic crisis in Mozambique, as well as serious food security concerns. After undergoing a 10-year liberation war against Portugal and a civil war from 1977 to 1992, Mozambique held its first democratic elections in 1993. The Frelimo Party seized power in 1975 and fought their political opposition, the South Africa-funded Mozambican National Resistance, or RENAMO, in a brutal civil war. Since the end of the civil war in 1994, Frelimo has faced allegations of election interference, which it has consistently denied. The party has a history of employing political violence to quash dissent. The lack of democratic stability and use of political violence, in addition to government scandals and food security concerns within the population, has led to a general apathy and mistrust of the government among Mozambicans. These sentiments of apathy and mistrust are exacerbated by the ongoing armed conflict in Cabo Delgado between Islamic State adherents, the Ansar al-Sunna, and Mozambican security forces, as well as ethnic tensions in the region, leading to a risk of further societal polarization, extremism, and violence. Four candidates are vying to replace the incumbent president, Philippe Nyusi. Daniel Chapo, the Frelimo candidate, is a law professor and former governor of Inhambane province and is considered somewhat of a fresh face. Venancio Mondlane is considered Chapo's primary competition and is running unaffiliated. The official opposition, RENAMO's candidate, is Usefo Momede, who is not widely considered a serious candidate. The final candidate is Luturo Simango, the MDM, who is the brother of the deceased former leader of the MDM, Davies Simango. The African Union, European Union, and the Southern African Development Community observed the voting process, as well as local groups like Mais Integrade. Observers reported peace and no major incidents of violence, but still stressed the risk of violence might arise as votes are counted and finalized. Earlier, municipal elections saw protests, which the state quashed with excessive violence. There were reports of election observers being refused access to polling stations. This led local election watchdog Sala de Paz to raise alarm over numerous irregularities. Centro Integrado, a local NGO, also found evidence of up to 5% of ghost voters, or simply non-existent people registered to vote. A key example is the Gaza province, where the Frelimo candidates received an overwhelming percentage of the vote, possibly due to the fact that there are more voters on the rolls than citizens in the province. The MDM is undertaking a parallel vote along with the official government vote count. As of this writing, there are no official results, but the overall consensus is that the race is too close to call. In addition to the election controversy, the particularly rich northwest province of Cabo Delgado has been subject to insurgency and ethnic tensions. It must be stressed that while Islamists in name, the Ansar al-Sunna, which has been embroiled in the conflict with Mozambican security forces, has no affiliation with Islam. The group is frequently composed of or assisted by dissatisfied state officials and have actively broken sacrosanct tenets of the faith and has broken fully with the Hadith. This group is seen by experts not as an attempt to create an Islamic state, but rather to create business opportunities for the informal elites in Cabo Delgado. The conflict between Ansar al-Sunna and the Mozambican security forces has grown with the addition of the Rwandan Defense Force and the Rwandan National Police fighting alongside the state. Further complicating matters is that there appears to be no central leadership behind the al-Sunna. Instead, the group seems to be a collection of unaffiliated warlords attacking government structures and terrorizing local populations, in addition to destabilizing plans for liquefied natural gas plants in Mocimboa de Praia. The Terrorist Research and Analyst Consortium, or TRAC, has tracked the group's significant shift from attacking government structures to terrorizing local populations with extreme violence. Instability in Mozambique's government and economy is ripe for exploitation for groups like Ansar al-Sunna in Cabo Delgado. To further their goals, Ansar al-Sunna seeks to take advantage of widespread apathy, mistrust of the government, and food insecurity to recruit dissatisfied youth seeking change. In addition, the group utilizes parts of the Quran as a recruitment tool. The fact that Cabo Delgado has the highest illiteracy rate in Mozambique only adds to the potential for exploitation. Another cause for concern in the region is the ethnic tension between the Mokende, the Makua, and the Mwani people. The Makua are the largest ethnic group in Mozambique and have a historic record of ruling Cabo Delgado. As such, they began to view the Makonde people as lesser, creating systems that ensured the Makonde would not seize the levers of power. The opposition situation occurred between the Makua and the Mwani people. Recently, however, the Makonde people have gained control over economic opportunities in Cabo Delgado and have worked to marginalize the primarily Muslim Mwani people. This marginalization, in combination with Ansar al-Sunna's violence towards civilians and active recruitment efforts, only serves to further societal polarization and insecurity. As the UNDP has reported, extremism is born from governmental distrust and insecurity. Mozambique, regardless of who comes to power, must work to systemically undo this extremism, not with violence, but with adequate socioeconomic provisions, financial stability, and diffusing ethnic tensions. The Lemkin Institute will continue to monitor elections and ongoing armed conflict in Mozambique during this point of potential change for the country. Now to Sudan, where the year-and-a-half-old civil war shows no sign of waning. In late October, the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces took the news of the defection of one of its top commanders to the government-backed Sudanese armed forces, with a major attack across the state of Gezira, leading to mass killings, the raping of women and girls, the widespread looting of markets and homes, and the burning down of farms. In the wake of the campaign, there have been many reports of suicide by women who were brutally raped, with other stories surfacing of women who are contemplating taking their own lives out of fear of sexual violence at the hands of the RSF. Targeting civilians is not a new tactic to the RSF or the SAF. UN experts have warned that both parties in the conflict in Sudan have been, quote, using food as a weapon and starving civilians. Since the outbreak of fighting, both groups have engaged in, quote, indiscriminate and deliberate attacks against civilians. However, as the violence continues, exacerbating existing crop shortages, the RSF and SAF have not needed bombs or heavy artillery to harm civilians. By blocking aid, they are able to target civilians with hunger. More than a year after fighting broke out in Sudan in April 2023, hunger is widespread throughout the country. Some areas faced food scarcity even before people began to flee the high conflict areas such as Khartoum en masse. Now that the RSF and SAF have largely blocked humanitarian aid corridors, The Integrated Food Security Phase Classification's Famine Review Committee has determined that some of these areas are plausibly experiencing famine. In its report, the committee focused on the Zamzam camp, a camp for internally displaced people in North Darfur. With most access roads to Zamzam blocked by the RSF, the area is all but inaccessible to aid organizations, thereby hindering their ability to deliver food, medicine, and essential supplies. The committee found strong evidence that the current situation in Zamzam amounts to famine. In September 2024, more than 29,000 children under the age of 5 were screened in the camp. The committee found that 10% of these children suffered from life-threatening severe acute malnutrition, and that an additional 34% were at risk if not treated in a timely manner. Though its recent analysis was restricted to the Zamzam camp, the committee has concluded that other areas of Sudan are likely experiencing famine and that the situation in the country will only worsen as long as fighting continues. In other areas of Sudan, Reuters reports that the SAF has blocked aid, forcing the UN to either withdraw aid or bypass the SAF, a move that would undermine the Sudanese government's sovereignty. UN experts claim that existing resolutions have been ineffective at getting aid past the SAF blockades. These experts argue that a, quote, resolution that clearly authorizes the UN to deliver humanitarian relief without government consent is needed. In Kadugli, a city in South Kordofan, residents have reported that a third faction, the Sudanese People's Liberation Movement North, or SPLMN, has also been responsible for blocking aid. The World Food Program delivery logs confirm that there has not been aid delivered to the city, which has been under the SPLMN control since October 2023. Meanwhile, the SPLMN has called for the UN to find a way to deliver aid to regions blockaded by the SAF. As the UN and international aid organizations failed to deliver food to people experiencing extreme food shortages, local responders have led aid efforts by delivering millions of meals a day. While international donors and governments have been reluctant to support these community-based initiatives, UN human rights experts have called for the international community to make their aid funding more flexible so that it can be used to help such initiatives. Beyond conscious aid blockages, pre-existing crop shortages have made the situation in Sudan even worse. Active fighting between the RSF and SAF, as well as potential corruption within some aid organizations, have also deterred aid delivery. The Lemkin Institute is deeply concerned for the more than 26 million people in Sudan experiencing acute hunger in what has become the world's largest hunger crisis. The situation will only worsen so long as violence, aid blockages, and refusal to push aid through despite these blockages continues. The deliberate use of starvation as a weapon is a war crime, and the SAF and RSF must cease blocking aid to areas under their opponent's control. The Lemkin Institute urges the international community to find a solution to delivering aid and support local aid efforts. That's all we have time for on this episode of Genocide News Now. This episode was produced by Noelle Jones with excellent research and writing from Dan Keevy, Nathalie Stein, and Lauren Fahouri, and editing by me, Molly Reagan. For a source list, please check the show notes. You can find new episodes of Genocide News Now in your feed every other week. To follow the Lemkin Institute's work, be sure to subscribe to us on social media. You can find us at Lemkin Institute, all one word, on Instagram, X, Facebook, WhatsApp, and Telegram. And for more on our work in the field of genocide prevention, visit our website at www.lemkininstitute.com. Thank you for listening and have a great day.